Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Steph, and this is the Don't Buy Her Flowers podcast. I hope you're really well. The sun is shining as I record this, so that is something. I don't think I've any major news from the Douglas household. We are just holding it together. It's one of those months when one or other of us is away, so I'm trying to do some deep breathing, eat cereal for tea a couple of times a week, which I think is okay. Put some banana in it and you're all right. My youngest has suddenly grown up, so he's five, and he's taken up Nerf guns, which are around the house from my elder son, who doesn't play with them anymore, but just means you're likely to get pelted with a bullet at any point, so it keeps me on my toes. Also, he's into football and likes to nutmeg me when I'm trying to move around the kitchen, so that, for anyone that doesn't know, that's kicking the ball between your feet. It's really, really annoying. That just means I'm falling over and being battered with Nerf guns quite a lot. So today's episode is a business special episode where I talk to a founder, and we do these episodes once a month. And I try not to do that gushy thing about guests, as I think it's a weird thing that podcast hosts do, and it can leave you as a listener feeling a bit on the outside. However, as a business founder myself, Alex DePledge is a proper business legend, and I can't help be a bit gushy. She is currently growing her second tech business, having sold her first, Hassle.com, for €32 million. Her current business, Resi.co.uk, is the UK's largest and only nationwide residential architectural platform. So they kind of guide you through the whole process if you're having worked onto your house, rather than having to manage lots of different elements and lots of different people and learn a new language in the process of doing it. So their aim is to save customers money and time, as well as make it a kind of less torturous experience. So we talk about the story behind her businesses, but we also go into how to make it work with a family, Alex's experience of burnout, and being a vulnerable leader, and also just what the role of a leader is compared to what we maybe thought it would be and the responsibility that comes with that. And I have to add that recently I was having a bit of a wobble, just questioning whether I knew what I was doing. Can I do it? What do I know? I think probably pretty normal. In fact, I think she said to me, if you don't think you're getting it horribly wrong at least once a week, then you're not doing it right. But we went for lunch, and she's so straight talking. She's not going to encourage you to do something she thinks is a terrible idea, but she's also a really big supporter of others and kind of gets the challenges. And in doing research for this, I found more than a couple of references to Alex as being a breath of fresh air. And one said that in a heavily male tech world, it's not because she's female, but because she's straight talking, masses of energy, and doesn't seem to have an ego or something to prove, which is really refreshing. This episode is sponsored by HR Star, who can help small businesses with HR, and I will explain a bit more about them in the episode. But over to my conversation with Alex DePledge. So how are you doing? Really?
Honestly, actually, all right. Bizarrely, Jules keeps saying to me, so how long is this new version of you going to last? I'm super positive and I'm like, life is great. Everything's going to be fine this year. And she's just like, can I get the old version back? I prefer the negative version of you.
Because Jules is your business partner. So we should probably start with that. Because you've co-founded two businesses with her.
Yeah, so Jules is my co-founder for this business and my previous business. She's also my best friend. We met when she was 20 and I think I was 25. So we've been friends a long time. It's really funny because I'm Alex and she's Jules. So most investors and bank managers think that we're men, which is quite funny because we've got androgynous names. So it's always quite a delight to surprise people.
Yeah. If we start with what became Hassle.com. So I think I first kind of found you talking on podcasts about Hassle.com and the fact that you'd sold it for €32 million, which all sounds very impressive. I'm sure there's loads more to it than that. But it was essentially, it was like matching cleaners with people who are looking for cleaners as a service.
Exactly. So it didn't start out like that. First of all, it's called Teddle, because we wanted something memorable like Google. And we started trying to build a local services marketplace. So for people who wanted like a dog walker or a tutor or a mobile hairdresser or a cleaner. And it's actually really hard, it turns out, to start a business across multiple categories, because every category behaves differently. Mm. And you have to market every category. So we were about ready to give up sort of a year and a half into it, when I won't tell you about the full meltdown that I had, but I had an epic meltdown and threw my teddy at the cot. And we started to look at the data before we kind of packed it in, because I was going to go get my job back. And we found out that like 1 in 4 people coming to the site were looking for a cleaner. So we were like, oh, that's bizarre. We don't have any cleaners. And that was kind of our like light bulb moment. And that's essentially how I ended up building Europe's largest cleaning marketplace. It was like pure accident.
We've talked about the fact, basically, when the shit hits the fan and your back's against the wall, if you're the sort of person who has started a business, which makes you a certain type of person, probably, that's when you almost flourish most, and you kind of go, you look for solutions and you keep going and you drive forward. And that's exactly what you did with Hassle.com.
Yeah, it is 100%. And people often ask me about starting a business. Mm-hmm. Like if I had it for a pound for every time someone told me they got an idea, I'd be like really rich and wouldn't need to work. But for me, it's like there's always loads of great ideas. The actual difficult bit is getting started. And people always think that they need to have a business plan and a bank loan, and they need, you know, they kind of need a product. And actually, I think people are at their most innovative when they literally have nothing, when it's just chaos. And it's that creation that comes out of that chaos, which is, it ends up being something you would never have imagined if you'd had money and resources and a plan and a team and all that. Do you know that all that other stuff you imagine is part of business? Actually, business at its rawest form is literally you having nothing and fashioning something together. And that's the bit about business that I like really, really love.
So I think people like who are serial entrepreneurs, I think they're not that interested once it gets past that really gritty bit, because it's when you kind of have to, you like I say, you flourish. But I think I've learned a lot in the last couple of years from Don't Buy Her Flowers, and that it grew so quickly, and a lot of that was to do with circumstance. Like we were in the right place at the right time, but also people were looking for our product and we did it well. So there's an element of that was the hard work bit, but there was a lot of luck involved. But when we then got further down the line, like, actually we need to scale some stuff back because the market has changed and it is quieter and we can't run in the same, like operationally at the same rate, actually that meant we had to strip some stuff back. And you realize that you've added things in that actually you don't need, or you're paying someone else to do something, which when you're really busy and the money's flowing in, it's very, very easy to take on, isn't it?
And everyone always wonders why big companies lose ground to startups. And it's, that's the answer is right there. It's the bloat. Because like you think about it, big companies, they've got everything. They've got the best workforce, the right idea, the market, the data, the product, everything. Mm. Logically speaking, startups should not be able to come in and undercut a competitor, but they can because of exactly that, the bloat and the fact you take your eye off the prize and then you end up accumulating stuff you don't actually really need. Mm. Everyone's got a person sitting in the corner of an office with a spreadsheet and you've got no idea what they really do. Yeah. And it's avoiding that that's the hardest in business. And I think like you, we've been in exactly the same place over the last sort of 2 to 3 years. You know, we've gone from like 150 down to like just over 100. And that's fluctuating over the pandemic and then coming out of the pandemic, then inflation and now where we are today. And it just makes you realize like actually how few people you need to run a business, which I probably shouldn't say that on in a public forum, but it's true.
Yeah. Or that there's jobs that you assigned to a person and it's like actually they could do all these other things. And it's not to say you completely max out somebody until they're broken, but sometimes you're kind of reserving a role for someone else separate that actually it could be that person can do it. But just on your current business, because obviously you sold one business for a huge amount of money, and there's some really good podcasts actually. You're on Secret Leaders, which is a great podcast talking about your kind of story, and there's another one as well, so I'll put links to those where you kind of go through all your journey so far. But talk about Resi. What do you do?
Once Jules and I exited Hassel, which again, like you talk about luck in business, that was, we weren't looking for an exit. That was 100% luck, right time, right market, all that kind of stuff. But after that, we were both like, oh my God, I'm never doing that again. And I'd had a baby. Well, I had Harper in the February, and then I sold the company in July. So I think she was 2 weeks old when I was on a plane to Germany to negotiate this like sale. Cause if Joe, it was just, you look back on it and you're just like, how on earth did I think that that was like a good idea? But yeah, you just do these things, don't you? I remember Jules arriving and I just got out of the hospital, and Harper wasn't even 24 hours old, and she walked in with a present for the baby and her laptop stuffed in the present bag so that Dave, my husband, couldn't see it. And she sort of took me in the kitchen when it was kind of appropriate, and she was just like, I can't do this without you. You need to like input, like this company's going to get sold. And we were just like, oh my God, this can't happen at the same. I've just had a baby less than 24 hours ago.
Yeah.
So anyway, that whole process took like 3 months. So she was 3 months old when I sold the business, and I was meant to stay there a year. And that lasted 6 months before. It was just untenable. So there was 9 months passed really before I actually got to know my child. And so when I kind of got out of that business, I was like, yeah, I'm never doing that again. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm never, ever, ever running a business again. And that lasted like 6 months. And the reason for that was because I started doing an extension on the side of my house. And as everyone does, like in these life moments, whether you get married, you have a child, you've got an elderly parent moving in, you get divorced, like whatever, it's usually key life moments when you think about either renovating your house or moving. And so I started doing this, and it wasn't anything mega, mega wrong with it, but it was really analog. Lots of spreadsheets, lots of site visits, lots of just... didn't really know what I was doing. It's the one thing that you're probably going to do one, maybe twice in your entire life. And you have to learn this massive amount of technical knowledge to feel any way comfortable about what the decision you're making. So like, who knows what building regulations are, like whether you need a structural engineer, you know, if your foundations need underpinning, all of this stuff. And it is stuff, literally stuff that an architect will ask you and you're just like, oh. So that was the kind of kernel of the idea for Resi. I was like, nobody has thought about this from a consumer perspective, and no one's taken technology and just made it a bit easier. So that's essentially what we did with Resi, is we built like floor to ceiling, full stack solution, whatever you want to call it, that takes you from your idea all the way through to your completed project. And it's all done online. So it's, you know, you can imagine the pandemic for us, demand went through the roof right at the time that we couldn't actually meet supply. So that was quite fun. But that's how we essentially got started, is I did an extension, and then I started researching into the trade and realized like how unproductive it was and how little architects actually got paid. There's just lots and lots of reasons to go into this area. But so I rang Jules up and convinced her that it was a good idea, and she was like, oh my God, not again. And here we are 7 years later. but I just think there's a reason that people didn't do it, and it's because it's really, really hard.
You've got to manage a lot of people, right? Loads of layers. So the idea being that you make it quicker for people, ideally less expensive, and you've got some really nice your bullet points that you give. Go on, give them.
We're faster, we're more affordable, it's a really high quality of work that you get from us, but then we join all the dots. So I think the best way to describe Resi is it just, your account manager just stays with you through that whole journey. So when you're facing, the builders told me that I need to pay X.
Yeah.
We're like, well, we can help you work out whether that's true or not. And it's just that sort of, it's like a comfort blanket. It's that reassuring comfort blanket around the whole process. And, you know, we are very like, at the minute, very focused on making sure that if we're going to come in and rip out your roof or the back of your wall and put an extension on, we also look at the whole house and make sure we can see how we can make your house more comforting, i.e. save you money on your bills, which is a huge problem for people right now, is as well as needing more space, they need the houses to work a lot harder for them. So again, I seem to have fallen into a sector that just seems to be right time, right place. But yeah, purely through looking at it as a consumer, because most people were just like, but you're not an architect, how can you go and do this? And it was like, well, probably a good question, but I think that's exactly what it needed, is someone who wasn't an architect looking at it and going, actually advocate for the consumer in this instance. So
when that's all the best ideas, right, where you've looked at it from a consumer point of view, because otherwise you're just telling people you'd be repeating what people, what architects have been doing for years and years in the same thing.
It's the same insight you had with like, please don't buy me flowers. That's just work.
Yeah.
You know, it's when you go through it, you kind of have these insights yourself. And I've now done like 4 renovations, and trust me, every time I do another one, I learn a bit more about what we should be doing better. So I'm like the company guinea pig, if you like, as well as it's boss.
You have to manage loads of people across lots of different elements of the job. And yeah. then they've got whole networks of people that they're dealing with. So I was listening to you talk about hiring and how it used to be that it was like you would be looking at their CV and what experience have they got and that kind of thing. Because I think, especially for small businesses, so someone who might be listening to this, hiring people is actually terrifying because yeah. you kind of think, oh God, if I don't get it right. And you want to have, you want them to be the right fit. And but also you want them to help your business and help you so that you're yeah. not doing more by having to sort of handhold someone. So what have you learned about hiring?
Oh God, that I'm really bad at it. I used to be really bad at it. I think that like the kind of like common kind of way of thinking about hiring is, you know, you need to get someone with the right attitude and the right skills. And if you do that, then it'll work. And actually what I found out is it's a lot more nuanced than that. So the place that I usually start is that if you want the output of the team to be greater than the sum of the parts, then you actually have to look at a company as a sum of parts. And so I might need role X and I've already got three people in that area. What I need to be doing is not just looking at the skills that person needs to bring in, but how these three people already work and how that new person's going to slot in. So the best piece of work I ever did was I had a leadership team and on paper, they were fantastic, but in practice, we just didn't seem to get the throughput and the output that you would expect for that many people doing that job at that level. And it turned out it's because I'd hired loads of people that were the same. And I don't mean the same, doing the same job or having the same skills. Like they were all across the operation, but they were the same type of person. So they were introverted, steady. They didn't challenge the status quo. They weren't drivers. They were decision by committee. And so what I actually did was map my leadership team out onto, and you can use any of those behavioral charts, but I did it on the DISC profiling, you know, the kind of red, blue, green, yellow. Mm-hmm. We were all greens and yellows. So no wonder we never got anything done because there was no numerate analytic people like blues, and there was no drivers. There was no people with the drum going faster, faster, faster. And you need kind of a balance. And so now when it comes to hiring, every single person before we even look at a CV or we look at their experience or anything like that, we have a character composition for that role that we check through a series of questions so we understand across the five characteristics of humans what sort of person's going to be coming in the building. Because if they don't fit the existing team, doesn't matter how good they are and what the experience is, the team won't function to its maximum potential.
Because also you talk about hiring people with grit, and I think especially if you're in a small business, you can't afford to have someone who comes along who might be really, really skilled, but they're kind of sitting, waiting to be told what to do. Mm. And they'll work in a certain way. Like you need people who also, like when we're hiring now, it's like, are they going to pack boxes? They're not being hired to pack boxes, right? But if they're corporates, yeah, would they? When we're going, fuck, we've been on Lorraine and there's like hundreds of orders coming in. Can they do that? And that's become quite critical because, and actually we've been pretty lucky because I think the core team are all those kinds of people. If you don't ask that or kind of try and figure that out quite early, you could get someone in who then everyone's like, well, she's not willing to get it. And then there's becomes a bit of a them and us, doesn't it? Even if it's not from you, within your team, you can see it and you're like, shit, how do I fix that? And it can be very much about personality.
So I can't remember exact stat, but someone once told me this, and I think it's so, so true, is that a bad hire costs you twice. So it's not just that you've missed an opportunity to have someone in the business for like 6 months that was producing, but it's double dinged because it's actually then you have to replace them and then get that other new person. So you can lose like a year hiring the wrong person. And so, yeah, I think it's someone once said to me, I didn't realize how important people were, but actually they're the only thing that's important. And I really believe that now. And so, yeah, all my effort now goes into people, either the development of them in the company or the hiring of them. And it's certainly not what I thought I was going to be doing in this job. Like you think I'm going to do strategy and I'm going to do vision and do that stuff. But actually 80% of all of my time is like people.
I so agree. Like I think basically it feels like I do HR a lot of the time. It's just managing to make sure that things are all happening, isn't it? It's like,
I know. And I'm going to say something that's probably, I don't think it'll win me any kind of popularity contest. So I apologize in advance, but I found now that the hardest part of my job is the amount of responsibility everybody expects an employer to have. So I genuinely at times feel like people's mental health therapist, their coach, their mentor, their career counselor, their mother, their friends, their social life, their source of wealth. It's just like all of these things that you have to like now consider about people, and it's exhausting. I actually think that the employer has taken over quite a bit of the burden of the state, you know, because there's so much pressure on the NHS and on all the services that everybody needs to make their lives run, that actually people, the slack is being picked up by business. And I realise that won't be very popular thing to say.
But that's changed as well, hasn't it? Because I think younger people coming into work have a much higher expectation of all the good stuff that I suppose we probably felt once we work to a certain level, we'll get. I don't know, you know, like whether that's flexibility or benefits or whatever that stuff. Whereas I think people come into it now expecting it. I don't think it's a bad thing for you to point out that that actually does put a mass, especially small businesses or small to medium businesses who employ, what is it, 44% of the UK's workforce, which is massive. And you don't have loads of support and you don't have big teams around you necessarily. And you're right, it can put a huge strain on, because also you're trying to make this business work.
Yeah, and I think it was the same throughout the pandemic, you know, with like the furlough scheme and all of this additional stuff that got brought in. I think it's really hard when you're a small business and it's you and maybe one other person that's carrying the brunt of that responsibility. Mm-hmm. Like the stress that puts on you, knowing that you have to furlough someone or you might have to make them redundant, or when this, you know, there's more and more legislation constantly coming through saying you have to do this, you have to do that. And it just adds a lot of burden and cost into small businesses that are only just staying afloat as it is. So they generate about 60% of our GDP. Small businesses in the UK are the backbone of the UK economy, but I think they're often overlooked when it comes to legislation and things coming in. And we don't realise this burden that we're putting on small businesses that they have to carry, both like from an economic point of view, but for me, from a mental health point of view.
This business episode is sponsored by HR Start, a HR consultancy who can offer businesses support, and their aim is actually to reinvent the poor reputation of HR. They say that HR are not just the department brought in to hire or fire, and they want to help you with people, who are your number one priority, because without the people, you don't have a business. At Don't Buy Her Flowers, we started working with HR Start a couple of years ago when the business had grown to the point that we needed to be really clear on workplace policies and how we look after the team, but we weren't of the size where we would have a permanent HR person in-house. I think when you're growing a business and there's so much going on, it's just really helpful to have experts to run things by, so we know we're doing the right thing, help with the admin of contracts and that kind of thing, and creating a business where you're proud to employ people, working with HR experts who actually know what they're doing. So if you visit hr-star.co.uk for more information, and if you contact them and quote DBHF, they'll give you 10% off their people strategy session.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Because you've talked about having burnout. I don't know if you call it a breakdown.
And I burnt out, that was all, as most people do. And this is going to sound really weird when I say this, but I am so glad that I burnt out at a young age. I'm so glad that I went out the trap doors and I just went mental for about 5 or 6 years and then fell over. Because what that's enabled me to do is take a lot of the measures that I find people take when they having their first child. And because we're not having our first child till we're 32, 33, whatever, we don't redress the imbalance in our life until then, or we try and do it when we've got a baby. Whereas because I was 27 and I was like, actually, this is really hard. Like, I can't have this amazing career that I really want and a family and find space for myself. I had to take a lot of those learnings out of that period and sort my balance out of my work and what I wanted to do. And had I not done that, I don't think I would have become an entrepreneur.
What did you do? What did you change?
I think the first thing is I recognize the signs of it now. Like, there's some really clear signs for me around sciatica, ocular migraines, lack of sleep, like waking up at 3 a.m. and my brain worrying, any of those signs. And immediately I know that, like, I'm on a slippery slope and I need to pull something back. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. But the second thing was that I realized that if I stayed in a company, because I don't think, and you'll agree with this, like, you don't work any less when you work for yourself. In fact, you probably work more and it's more consuming because it's all you think about. But what you do have is a freedom over when and how you work without anyone telling you, you have to be in this office at this time or you have to work these hours. Or so what is nice about doing what we do is that actually we can make our family fit quite snugly around that. Is it ideal? No, it's not, but you do have that flexibility. And they were the two things that I realized is that I couldn't, if I wanted to do what I like, the career that I wanted, I couldn't stay inside a big corporation as they were then, 12, 13 years ago. I'm sure it's changed now. And it's just made sure that, like, now going into it, I've never burnt out since then. I've had episodes where I've kind of gone, ooh, I need to change some stuff up. But because I recognize the warning signs, where I now, it's awful. And you, I don't know if you've had this in your company, but especially in the last 3 years, like, we've had a couple of suicide attempts. And we've had, and we're with a larger workforce, you're going to get that. But also we've had people breaking down in front of my eyes. And I know that they are because I can see it, but they don't recognize it. They don't know. And it's one of those things that you can take a horse to water, but you can't force it to drink. And that's what I've seen a lot of in my workforce is watching that happen to other people and feeling totally helpless because I can see what's happening, but I can't stop it. So I'm really glad it happened to me when I was young.
Yeah, and I think also you can see it and you can address their work stuff and go, like, right, what do we need to do to support you at work? But often, I suppose, going back to the idea that you are also mother and boss and all those other things, it's always both, isn't it? Like, when someone's struggling at work, it's not just work. It will be, or they'll be struggling at work and it's nothing to do with work. It'll actually be stuff that's going on at home. And that's
and it just where, bleeds into work, yeah.
Of course it does, because that's where we spend so much of our time. But then, you're not taught any of this, are you? So how do you know how to be? Especially if you want a culture that where everyone is comfortable to talk and everyone does get on the majority of the time and can voice their opinions and all that stuff. Because you talked about one of the reasons that you wanted, when, with your first business, one of the reasons that you wanted to get out when it had sold was because the culture just became completely different to the one that you'd created because you weren't in charge anymore and you hated it.
Well, that happened here though as well in COVID. I don't know if it happened at all with you, but I definitely feel, and this was definitely 100% my fault, the culture here changed through COVID. And I think it was a lack of an experience from my part because I'll never forget being on a phone call with someone that I won't name publicly, but quite a famous high profile entrepreneur. And I was like, oh my God, what are you doing? Like, this was before the furlough scheme came out. And he's like, well, Alex, I've just got off a phone call. And on it was Mervyn King. But yeah, so he was on there. And then there was Warren Buffett. And then the head of the US Federal Reserve. Right. So this is the colour of the conversation. And someone pipes up on this call and goes to Warren Buffett. So, hey, Warren, like, what do you think is going to happen? And Warren Buffett just turns around and goes, well, I'll be fucked if I know. And it's just like, you know, like the leading kind of economists, like people that have been running the global economy for years had no idea. So I definitely was like emotionally leaking everywhere across the company in this period. I didn't know what to do. I wasn't sleeping. I thought I was going to have to make loads of people redundant. And then when the furlough scheme came in, I was elated, but nobody really knew how it worked or what was the procedure, how many letters, how much consultation, all this kind of stuff. And then when I put people on furlough, some people reacted badly. And in my head, I was like, oh my God, I've just saved your job. You know, like I got really angry. I was like, how can you be so inconsiderate and ungrateful and all this stuff? So I literally was projecting.
It was so hard though, because suddenly people were forced into situations with maybe with partners or kids or whatever that wasn't their ideal. And so it was just this merge of, you couldn't keep work and home separate. And also, like, we'd be in the warehouse because I went to the warehouse a lot more than I would normally. It was kind of, because for me, the thing I recognized quite early on is that I need to be there packing boxes, shifting stuff around, because it was so busy it would have been really wrong to not be part of it. But yeah, it was really challenging. And like you, we were busy, so there's a bit of you that's thinking, I can't complain, because there's all these businesses and leaders who are really screwed and we're
going
actually
under.
And we're doing really well out of this awful thing. I was very emotional. We were on Lorraine. The lockdown was announced on like the Sunday or the Friday, but the Sunday was Mothering Sunday, whatever it was. And I just was in bits. We'd had this like 5 days of just it building and building and building, orders coming in. It's like, how do we keep everyone safe? We've got to keep them all distanced and all that stuff. And I just kept crying by the Friday because I was just like, and also I was really emotional at how amazing the team had been.
I know.
But then you're kind of conscious of going, am I meant to look like this when I'm trying to lead a team? But I don't know, because part of you goes, they can know that you're vulnerable. They want to work for a person. They don't want to work for some bitch who has no heart and is oblivious to the fact that all this shit's going on. I don't know.
I know, but I definitely think like it would have been easier to be a bitch through that whole process, wouldn't it? Because, like, in terms of like on yourself, because I was exactly like you, just all over the place. And actually subsequently as well, because I think the last couple of years after COVID haven't been that predictable either. And what I mean by that is like macro events, you know, like for us, when Liz Truss's budget was announced, we didn't sell anything for 2 weeks. No. And I was like, oh my God. Same. Every time I said to someone, oh, but things can't really get any worse, they got worse. And I was like, come on, like, this is ridiculous. So now I think I'm just like, well, things are always going to get worse. And so now I'm like pretty chill, like very zen, very upbeat and positive. I've done it 180.
You tweeted about Jacinda Ardern and you said, not enough in the tank, sounds like every leader I know right now, very little consideration given to how hard it's been leading anything these last 3 years. Ardern just gets stronger in my mind about how you lead, honestly, authentically and kindly. And is that your aim for your leadership style?
Yeah, I think it is. I think if you said, you know, tell me what qualities are leadership material, men and women would probably say to you, decisive, strong, forthright. And they tend to be more masculine characteristics. Statistically, it doesn't lie. You know, less women get funding, less women build big businesses. There are less women in the FTSE 100 as CEOs, less women in every realm of like that space. So I think what Jacinda did was stand up and say what I had been thinking for 4 years, like 3 years, which is like, I just don't know if I've got any more to give. And she said it in a very public forum. And I think that, you know, it's a bit like, if you can't see it, you can't be it. I just really admired her for standing up and she could have made any reason, any sort of excuse to stand up and say, yeah, I'm not going to stand again. I'm not going to run. But she stood up and told it honestly. And I think if she said in a public forum what many of us, you and I included over lunch, and in many of our peers have been saying for the past 2 to 3 years, which is, this is really, really hard. And I don't think there's been a lot of credit given over to people in leadership roles over the last 3 years that have had to navigate a business through choppy waters, or they've had to get an organization out the other side and trying to keep people safe and keep people gainfully employed and motivated and energized and all that kind of stuff. And it's just mentally very draining. And I just thought, yeah, well done you. Really well done.
But it feels as if as well that the world of leadership and what people think of as good is changing. So I think I could quite often have, like, probably earlier in the business, looked at people who are they're probably in their 50s, like successful women, and they're power suited and their shoulder pad, you know, it's like Dragon's Den, you know, like the body con and all that stuff. And they've said to me, oh, you know, you need to, have you got a nanny? You really need a good nanny. Like, that's the solution for if you want to be a woman who works, you have to outsource everything. Because, and I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that's not what we've chosen to do, right? But that's kind of the solution. So it's like you have to behave like a man and get more help with your kids, because you can't possibly have your partner do that because he couldn't do that. And I just think hopefully that is changing, because our generation of business leaders aren't doing it necessarily like that.
I think it is. There are more dads at the school gate now. You know, my husband does all of the childcare in terms of in the week, because I'm in London and we did that, you know, stereotypical move out of London in lockdown thing that everyone seemed to do. So, you know, he does all of that. And there are definitely more dads involved now. And, you know, even between my two daughters, there was a 3-year age gap. There was more people at baby tambourine classes and all that stuff. And I do think with every generation, it gets easier. If I compare my husband to my dad, for example, you know, there's a light year and my dad to his dad. So we are making generational shifts. It's just, I think for a lot of women, it doesn't feel quite quick enough. And also a lot of our societal attitudes haven't caught up. Like, I mean, you know, at school, I go on a Friday. That's the only day I go. And it feels like the teachers save everything for a Friday to be like, oh, excuse me, Mrs. And then they'd offload on all the things that the girls didn't have that they needed this week. And I'm just like, why are you telling me? Why are you not telling Dave's here 4 days a week? Tell him. So it cuts both ways. It's not just a man thing. But I think in terms of like leadership, I'd like to think that I'm kind and I'm 100% authentic. Jules trademarked the crying CEO about 7 years ago. Because she's just like, every time I look at you, you're crying. You're either crying because you're really happy or you're crying because something's gone wrong.
That's okay though, right? Because that's the other thing. I suppose if you, you know, there was a really interesting episode of Woman's Hour with Leah Williamson, the England captain.
Yeah.
And she was talking about her leadership, and she was talking about when she got asked to be captain, that she was like, fuck, I don't know how to do this. But she sort of stood in front of everyone and said, I don't know how to do this. I'm going to need you to tell me if you've got ideas, if you think I'm doing something badly, if you want to have an input and all that stuff. And it was like collaborative, right?
Yeah.
Women are better at that. Like, we have been, because we've had to be, because we're juggling lots of stuff and we're having kids as well as all the other stuff. And I love her. I mean, I've watched a lot of documentaries about the Lionesses, and I'm not a massive football fan, but I just love their character and the way they are. And if you compare that to most male footballers, and it's like, oh, who do you want to be? I know which team I'd rather be on. Like,
yeah. No, it's just there's so many examples of that, I think, coming through now. So I think you're right. Like leadership and how we define it and what we expect from it is changing. It just so happens, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this, it's just we're just actually quite crap in the UK at like building a managerial class. You know, when everyone talks about this like lack of productivity and like where's this growth and like wealth generation coming from, there's lots of reasons for it, but one of the huge areas of concern is the lack of skill development, but also the lack of managerial class. And it's like, I don't think we're really taught how to be leaders or to, you know, set forth on creating something and then managing it kind of through. Like, we're very good in the UK at kind of academic learning, but academics doesn't really make you good at business. And I think that's like a huge area for concern sort of going forward.
Well, you go to school and you learn about the jobs that, well, especially when we were at school, that your parents did and that you can see. So there's a policeman and there's a teacher, and it's like, but the world of work is so different to that. I went and did a talk at Mabel's school about running a business. They want to get women in and not make a big thing of the fact that I was a woman going in, but just got me to talk about business to a load of 10-year-olds. So it was really interesting to do.
But it's good that there's so much more of that going on, because I don't know about you, but that never happened when I was small.
I was just going to ask you about network, because actually we met because you drunk messaged me.
Oh, God, I know.
I'm so glad you did.
I know it sounds weird, but I was just like, I think if we met in real life, we'd be friends, which is just like not something a 40-year-old woman really should be contemplating in life. And I just liked how authentic you were, and we had like very similar, I felt like quite similar lives. And so, yeah, that is, you are the only person that I've ever done that to.
But I took it as a massive compliment, because you're way further down the line in terms of business. You have really experience with investment and raising money and all those things. So when you got in touch, I was like, oh, she's a proper businesswoman, because that is how it feels. It shouldn't feel like that. And you've said actually that the idea that raising money is a business milestone is bullshit, which I quite like.
Yeah, it is. It's so funny, right? Because my admiration for you is that you've built a profitable business, which is something that, like, the way that I do it, the returns will be bigger, but it takes a lot longer to get there. And I think my dad got in my head when I was younger, saying, you're not really in business because your business is not profitable. But I guess that's the big difference. Like, you know, a startup and an SME are fundamentally different, right? Because an SME will sort of grow linearly. It, you know, it's probably single digits growth, and it's probably something like service or product based, whereas the whole idea behind startups and the idea that they could be the wealth generation of engine of the UK, which is what I'm so passionate about, is that actually they have the possibility to have exponential growth, which is why most of them are attached to technology in some way, because it's the technology that powers that sort of growth.
And then you need investment, right? Because
I think that's probably one of the things I'm probably almost better known for is like my advocacy within government and within business to try and get the right level of finance for the right businesses. Because the hardest thing for me, like going back 6 years, was to try and get the government to understand that an SME and a startup and a scale up and an enterprise company, they're not even the same characteristics in business. And therefore what they need is completely different. So you can't have a business policy because it just doesn't work. And so that's what I spent a lot of time outside of Resi doing, is basically trying to get the right level of funding into startup and scale-ups and high growth companies. And the reason for that actually is because, you know, women only get 2% of VC money. So at 98% of all of the billions, and I mean billions, of investment that goes into tech and high growth business in the UK goes to male founding teams. And it's because they don't look in the industries where women like you and I sit typically. Like, women tend to go into healthcare and beauty and things like that that male venture capitalists don't look at. And they also, you know, there's an unconscious bias there where they don't necessarily invest, because women will be the first people to put the conservative business plan in front of an investor, whereas a guy will walk in and, you know, put the I'm going to shoot for the roof and hit the moon type business plan. So that's kind of like my side job, if you like, is trying to get better financial instruments into more hands of women and minorities, so that we can actually build wealth to pass on to our kids in this country and pay people more and save the NHS. And then I get all lofty and sort of like, you know, I'm going to save the world in my ambition, but it would be a good start.
Yeah, it would be a good start. I'm very glad you did get in touch. I've learned loads when we've had a couple of lunches, and it's like, come back and go, oh, and then she said this, and there's this idea. I think, but that network is the idea that having a business can be really, really lonely. So finding someone that you can sit with every few months is great.
It is lonely, and I get really lonely, because even with a business partner, you can't always sort of offload everything, you know. Particularly, I mean, I've been in the position where the business is going out of business and that's happened to me a few times, and you're like, you can't talk to anyone. It also bears out in the data. If you look at the data, part of the reason that London and the Southeast prospers the way it does, and we've got this idea of needing to level up across the rest of the country, is because we do not have these clusters and these networks where not just information and mentorship and support is exchanged, but also money and connections and, you know, procurement processes and all these kinds of things. So, you know, the root cause of what we need to do in the UK is actually build that interconnectedness between cities and communities and sectors. It needs to join up, because statistically it's proven that when you get these kind of like networks and clusters, really good things happen in them and businesses thrive and entrepreneurs flourish.
Massive thank you to Alex and to HR staff for sponsoring this episode. We are taking a small break from the normal podcast at the moment, but we'll be back in a few weeks. And meanwhile, do go back and listen to all of the episodes on the Don't Buy Her Flowers podcast. And while you're there, and while you're here, if you'd like to leave us a review or rate the podcast, and you can subscribe, so then you'll get a notification when we put out a new episode, and share it and do all the usual things, that would be brilliant. And it's always really lovely to get feedback. Actually, you can DM me on Instagram or email podcast@don'tbuyherflowers.com. And thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a really good week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.